It is my pleasure to introduce Embassy Office Park REITs. Embassy Office Park REITs is Asia's largest REIT by area with development potential of 33 million square feet. To put it in perspective, the entire CBD area of Hong Kong is 28 million square feet lesser than the area of Embassy Office Park REITs, right? And the Embassy Office Park REIT is represented by Michael Holland, who is the CEO of Embassy Office Park REIT, Vikash Khadloya, Deputy CEO and COO, Aditya Virwani, who is the COO of Embassy Group and a director on the board of Embassy REIT, along with Ritvik Bhattacharji, head of the IR. I would now request Mike to please, you know, share the exciting story about Embassy Office Park REIT with all of us.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed. And so my brief is a 10-minute quick-fire overview and then discussion Q&A. So given the fact that we've got such a big crowd, I might expand my 10 minutes and then you do feel free on your Q&A. So, Mike Holland, I'm privileged to run what we believe is Asia's largest REIT. Just before we dive into that, to understand a little bit about the office market in India, today it's a 600 million square foot market across seven large cities, across a subcontinent that's really the size of Europe. When one talks about India, one really has to think about the segmentation of cities and regions and sub-markets within those cities. In terms of scale, that office market in 2000 was probably less than a million square feet of grade A type of premises. So the growth over the last 20 years has just been phenomenal. The typical absorption of new grade A office space over the last few years would be between 35 and 40 million square feet per annum across those cities. In the four markets that we operate in the last 4 years, it absorbed more than the 11 leading global cities in the office space across the world, including cities like New York and London. Bangalore, which is the city we're headquartered in, absorbed more space than Hong Kong, Beijing and Shanghai combined in the last 3 years, 56 million square feet. So, you know, it's a very, very significant sector of the real estate market. And what's driving that across those cities and therefore driving our business? You know, I'd start by saying the days of low-cost outsourcing are long gone. There's been a very significant move away from that type of user to a user that is a global captive center, that's a high-skill center. Today, the industry body that represents those is called NASSCOM, National Association of Software Companies. They report on over 1,250 captive centers in multiple different sectors employing over 4 million people. And those companies are there, and for us, they're more than 80% of them are international companies. Those companies are there because of the availability of high-skilled talent at great scale, at a time when in developed markets we have very high levels of employment, we have a lack of science, technology, engineering, mathematics graduates in terms of demand, and also at a time when major economies are making migration of skilled personnel more difficult, all of that drives, frankly, business into our type of space. So our portfolio that we listed on the 1st of April is a 25 million square foot office portfolio. It's in the four leading office markets of Bangalore, Pune, Bombay and NCR region, Noida. It comprises 11 different assets, seven very large-scale business parks. They're typically a 25-acre to 120-acre in terms of scale, and four city-centric offices. You'll see if you've got a book there some images of that. There's, again, to give you a feel for scale, there's over 200,000 people working within our parks and with our within our offices. The largest single park is called Manyata. It's in Bangalore. Bangalore is India's leading technology centre. It's also India's leading aerospace city. 100,000 people work in that park, Manyata. It's a 43% of the value of our portfolio is in that park. Again, to put it into context, 100,000 people. There were 70,000 people working at the World Trade Center. There's a similar number of people working at Canary Wharf. So that's one of our assets has that many people. It's lower rise, ground plus, say, five, but spread over 120 acres. And on those various parks, we have additional development potential of another 8 million square feet. That's highly value accretive. We'll happily talk about that in Q&A. The key strength of the portfolio is these 166 really A-grade international tenants. More than 80% of our tenant base are international companies. 43% of our rentals come from Fortune 500 companies. So it's it has been described as an international business based in India. We're fortunate that the comments about the domestic consumption slowdown that's there in India, that really has negligible, if any, impact on our business, because our business is catering to the international market and largely the international captives. There's a slide in the deck that shows you the type of tenants that we have, but just to roll out a few names in that 160, in the tech sector, we've got people like McAfee, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Salesforce in the pure tech sector. But we've got, that's half of the portfolio, but we've also got companies in the retail sector like Lowe's or Mast Global. As retail, in particularly in the West, comes under pressure, as companies move to the omni-channel retailing model, a lot of that business is being transacted and developed out of India. So great tenants in multiple different sectors. Again, we'll talk perhaps about that a bit later. We have got, in addition to the 11 office assets, we've got four ancillary assets, four hotels, and a 100 megawatt solar park. Rationale around that is as ancillary and in support of the business parks. We talk about a business a lot in our business about providing a total business ecosystem. So we're not providing standalone offices generally, unless it's that core CBD. We're providing these large-scale total business ecosystems that might have hotels, conference centers, creches, sports zones, food courts, and so on. Anything that is there to make the life of the corporate occupier more efficient and therefore more likely to stay with us, be attracted by us, and to pay higher rentals, which we would generally achieve a higher rental than our competing project. And finally, just to talk to the portfolio, although we do have that 8 million square feet of development within the portfolio in addition to the 25. Yeah, I often highlight we're not a developer. People have gone through a lot of pain with developers in India. In fact, in one of our meetings today, we all had a fairly good laugh at the fact that he was very pleased to hear that we were the first people who'd said that we had a couple of our new projects were two quarters ahead of schedule, and he'd never heard that out of India. So, we're not a developer. Our development on campus is really, we believe, the lowest risk form of development because we've owned the land for some time. So land title, which is often a source of problems in India, is there. Approvals are there in terms of the overall development. Again, that generally has been problematic and caused delays for developers, and of course we're surrounded by demand. The portfolio was put together since 2012, so another feature that one often hears and finds about India is things do take time. So between Blackstone and Embassy Group, who are the two entities who are the sponsors to the REIT, they pull that together from 2012. Vikash and I have been working on the management of that portfolio for over 4 years. We raised $680 million at the end of March and listed from 1st of April. It was certainly well received internationally. And being the first REIT in India, I think we have made good progress, but we've got more progress to make domestically in helping people to understand the concept of a REIT, the concept of that regular distributions plus potential for upside and total return. I think we've made a good step forward on that with our first quarter results, where our revenues and NOI were up 19% year on year. We made our first quarter distributions, and certainly the overall performance of the stock has been impressive. At the end of the quarter, it was up 22%. Today, you know, it's up to over 34%. So I think the domestic market's beginning to wake up and see the appeal. I think key reasons for success, and perhaps we'll touch on these in Q&A. India is a great and rapidly developing market. We're in the top four office markets in the country. Absolutely, you know, top tier strength is the quality of the tenant base. So the covenant of those 166 plus tenants is what ultimately pays that quarterly dividend and adds the value. We've got some great tenants in the portfolio. Average relationship size, again, to give some contrast and feel of scale, the average size of tenant relationships is over 150,000 square feet. So, you know, this is not a portfolio of small scale multi tenants. Our largest tenants are over 1 million square feet. We've got great assets. We've got a management team of over 70 people. It's an external manager as required by the regs, but a very active asset management approach to the portfolio. I mentioned that total business ecosystem. That's really a key part of our sales pitch to occupiers and how we do get outperformance on our rentals. High occupancy, we've run 93 to 95% occupancy for a number of years, and of course the growth levers are a contracted growth lever in the lease, the mark to market that comes at the end of lease expiries. Last quarter that was over 50% on the leases that we expired. We've got a great REIT framework that SEBI put together, and a number of parties inputted on that, but it started out as a copy and paste of Singapore regulations, related party controls, independent directors, and so on. And the overall framework and portfolio dynamics give a very clear line of sight to growth through that contracted rental income that's there under the leases with those 160 plus tenants, the growth that we achieve on the mark to market on lease expiry, the growth and the addition in the portfolio of that 8 million square feet on campus development. And we've got a number of ROFO assets from Embassy Group, one of the sponsors, and of course we've got the opportunity to go out and take third party acquisitions. So that's a 10-minute overview. I'm Vikash, and I will happily take some questions.
Is that Scott? I'm looking at 25 and 27, just kind of two big growth drivers for the market.
Yeah.
What is the translation of that?
So same store basis, NOI growth would be approximately 5-6% annually.
That's your expectation over the next, like, 3 years then?
That is correct.
And then on the development pipeline, the 4 million kind of near terms square feet and then another 4 million kind of in the out years.
So,
have you guys put out like an expected yield on that? And what, and just what's the total spend as well?
So typically the spends on this, you know, per square feet, we end up spending anywhere between $50-$60 a foot. In terms of the timelines as well, one of the things that we endeavor to do is to see if we can bring forward the deliveries. So if you see the 0.9 million square feet in FY22, that was actually 0.3 million square feet earlier. And based on how well we have done on the existing lease-up program as well as the market momentum, we have actually brought forward two of the blocks in one of our assets in Pune, which is in the west of India. And we have kind of, the you know, the endeavor is to deliver it faster and kind of get tenants faster so that the rentals start kicking in faster. Yields on new developments, given that the land is already paid for by the REIT, would anyway be in the low double digits. And, you know, sorry, in the high double digits, and including for the land would be low double digits. High teens. So excluding for the land, which is already paid for, it will be high double digits.
Okay. So you said, sorry, 50 to 60 square foot and kind of 4 million. So you're talking about like 200 million.
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, if there's one comment that we're hearing back that is challenging is the issue around liquidity. We do have strategics and sponsor lock-ins. The sponsor lock-in comes off on 31st March of next year for Embassy and Blackstone. I think they have both a fairly clear stated line of what's their position. Blackstone have talked about a number of years in terms of an exit. Embassy have consistently spoken about a permanent capital vehicle and staying in. I think there's limited liquidity at present, but there's certainly significant interest. So I think over the coming months we'll see more interest from domestics, and then I think perhaps in 2020 we might see some
so
more liquidity.
How has the register changed since?
It's still fairly an internationally dominated register. It's 21% free float that we put into the market. Off that, effectively, you know, 90% of the institutional register, which is effectively 90%. Of the book is an international investor base. And the reason for that is pretty simple, right? I mean, they, international investors like yourselves have just been used to the REIT product. They came in and drove, saying that a lot of the long-only names, the dedicated funds, they've come in. That evolution, so the domestic portion is predominantly comprised of high net worths. You've got some retail, but and a few of the domestic mutual funds. But I think they're really willing to see the performance in the stock. I think listed Indian real estate has performed rather underwhelmingly over the last few years, over the last decade, right? So I think people wanted to make sure that this REIT product, whatever a REIT is to them, you know, actually delivers on the promises and all the growth levers that we've laid out in all our presentations. And we wanted to clear up the first level. Number one, there is capital appreciation. Number two, we've paid out a distribution. And we can't mess around. And in India, I think the fundamental issue is that people have always messed around with things like dividend payouts. We paid out more in one quarter than companies do in an entire year. They're now beginning to see the fruits of that performance. The 10 to 12% of sort of the non-institutional money is going to change. We expect that to change. It's going to grow larger. And I think Mike's point now, and the SEBI over the last couple of weeks, actually changed the liquidity lots down to 200 from 400 so that it goes effective at the end of the month. These are all conversations that we're having. So we do expect a fair amount of uptick at some point.
So it's buying another one.
Correct.
It's still to come.
But the evolution of the register is still, look, what we've also found in the margin is that we travel the world, as you know, sort of talking to people. We've been seeing a lot of interest from global income funds, right, who are now looking from places like Japan, like Australia, who are sort of peering through the register just saying, hey, there is an asset in a high growth market that we think we should really take a look at. And we see, I mean, snippets, there's not a lot of stock, to Mike's point. I think it's certainly something that we're seeing some changes over there.
One of the drivers post-listing that we're focused on was the tax treatment for any vendors into the REIT. Massive tax advantages for any seller to sell to
uh-huh.
you,
yeah.
as opposed to into the market.
Yeah.
Okay, now that you're up and running and established, have vendors been approaching you?
Well, I think what we have seen is almost immediately post-listing, the conversation has shifted from the business as usual delivery to are there acquisition opportunities out there. We've looked at a number of acquisition opportunities. We're in discussion with a number of private owners. I mean, clearly, we need products to be the right type of quality and have synergy with our existing portfolio. I think that having paid out one quarter's dividend, having seen that capital appreciation, a couple more of those, and we would likely have some domestic current property owners who'd feel that the product has now got credibility for them to trade their property for units. Because the benefit that Sarah's referring to is that for Indian-listed REITs, of which we're the only one, there's a capital gains tax deferral on a swap-in for an asset. So that's a significant benefit at a domestic level. But equally, conversely, there's an awful lot of very poor quality second-tier product that people might want to do that, but we wouldn't perhaps be. It would be significant because that's the grade A stock. You have to take out all of the strata sold, so product that's been sold floor by floor or sub floor by floor. I would take a stab at that and say maybe half of that number, half, maybe a little bit more, given the fact that that growth has come over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. So that's much better quality. And in the last, particularly 5 years, but in the last decade, we've seen a move away from the fragmented market with small-scale, local, single-location developers into fewer, larger, more institutional developers and asset owners. So today, I think there probably no more than, certainly there wouldn't be 10 such players across the whole country. And I think if you, again, use that analogy about the scale of the market, in terms of geography, if you look at Europe, it's like saying, okay, there are 8 top-tier players delivering on the office market in that type of geography.
What's your net for Chanel?
I think we were trading at 4% above premium.
We do it semi-annually, so we will do next one in September, which we will then disclose in the November the results of Q2, which will come up in November. So the last NAV was 360-361, which was as of March.
Yes.
You referenced some of the regulatory issues or challenges that still exist in the market. Can you expand on that a little bit? I'm curious to understand where, you know, how that framework and that is evolving, and what challenges you still see, and you know, do you think that's an impediment to a, I guess, kind of foreign investment or you know, the creation of, or I guess the evolution of listed sector?
So a couple of things. I mean, we have been engaged with the regulator since the first time the regulations came up a couple of years back. Being a first of its kind product has its own challenges. But the regulator, to their credit, have been pretty amenable, and you know, they've been pretty proactive as well in listening and kind of you know, kind of executing on the plan of how to make REITs successful in India. A couple of things which we would like to get done today, let's say, is, for example, the guidelines for the fall on equity issuances. So it's not still in place for the REITs. Just yesterday they came up with a draft. So now we'll go through the consultative process, and maybe it may take another couple of months. But that's something we would like to be framed up and kind of ready, so that, you know, in case we do look at add-on acquisition opportunities. So that's one. The other thing I can think of is, because in India REIT is a trust structure, there are certain classes of lenders who are not permitted to invest in a trust. You know, so for example, the FPI investors, the foreign portfolio investors. So recently, again, the government has been listening, and the Honorable Finance Minister in the budget speech mentioned that the FPIs, they will now allow FPI investors to invest in the debt units of the REIT. Of course, that still needs to kind of be executed. So we're still awaiting notification from the central bank. But so these are certain items where, you know, one, you need to kind of correspond with the authorities, explain to them why there's a necessity. They understand it. They just want to ensure the investor interests are protected. And then, you know, from the intent to the execution to kind of the time it comes out as in a form which is kind of executable, it at least takes two or three quarters. And we at Embassy REIT want to ensure we are ahead of the game and kind of proactively engage each time. Having said that, I think the government and the regulators realize that it's very important from a market liquidity perspective, and from a institutionalizing the market perspective, and for the retail investors to have this REITs doing well in India and being successful.
If I can add, I think there's one major sort of structural difference between the way that the West looks at a REIT versus how the Indian regime. Over here, it's pretty much, it trades like an equity product. It was brought to the market, it trades one for one. I think the whole concept of, you know, the point about liquidity, I personally would love to see it go one for one at some point and really trade, give the same impetus. And it should be included in every index. It's one of India's largest companies by market capitalization right now, sort of in the top 100. I mean, there are companies significantly larger. But I think that sort of, you know, scale of actually getting the regulations down to a point where they start thinking that, you know, this is equity, this trades like equity, and this is really sort of power. And then, and it has all the benefit components of safe, you know, real estate with growth. I think that's the mentality that's going to take a little bit more time to gestate.
But I think, I mean, in some senses, I think that we've been through most of that over the last, you know, from the 2014 to 2017 period, going through the REIT regs, working with SEBI on, particularly on restructuring issues, on tax issues and so on. And in their own way, they listened, they heard, and they made those changes. I think it's really encouraging, actually, the recent budget, you know, had some dropped a few clangers, and quite quickly, central government worked to reframe that, particularly around the tax and FPI. So, as a general tone across the market, there's been some very positive changes over a number of the last few years, and we see that continuing. And the fact that we're now listed and delivering, again, I think that will reinforce the positive place that we're at. And for sure, there are other parties in that top tier of developers who are looking at the next REIT listing.
You're obviously mostly office REIT. You have a small hotel
Yeah, four hotel assets, yeah.
What's the plan for the portfolio mix going forward?
Yeah. So I mean, geographically, we would say we're very much focused only on the top six metros. So where we're not currently is Hyderabad and Chennai. Chennai, we have a ROFO asset of about 5 million square feet, where Embassy Group are delivering two build-to-suits, one for Accenture and one for Wells Fargo. So that's the Chennai market. Hyderabad, we see that as oversupply issues already there and coming through like a steam train. So perhaps that's something that we'll just keep an eye on and see if there's opportunities that come out. So that's geography. Sectors, we are an office REIT. We're focused on how can we synergize and lever off the 160 A-grade type of tenants that we cater to. So we're focused on expanding that side of the portfolio sector-wise. Hotels, the reason we have those four hotels is to support the business ecosystem. And so, again, we've often stated that if somebody was to offer, you know, an accretive price for that, then for sure, as long as we've achieved our objective, which is to have a hotel on our business park for the benefit of our tenants, then we'd certainly look at divesting something like that.
I think the interesting way to talk about the metrics that you get around the hotels and the occupancy.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite phenomenal, actually. We learnt a lot from the first hotel that was opened at Hilton at Golf Links, where Golf Links is a 4.5 million square foot park in the fairly central in Bangalore. And consistently during the week, that's running at mid-90s to over 100% occupancy. I mean, tonight, I looked at the report this morning, it's at 100% occupancy. Weekends, that will go down to 40, 45%. Year-round, therefore, it's ending up at 70 to 72%. But we get rentals for that hotel, which are, you know, frankly, matching some of the very best hotel properties in the city. And the whole rationale around it is that the occupiers on that park, and they would include companies like Swiss Re, Facebook have signed up, Dell have recently signed up, Salesforce are in that park. You know, they want their people to fly in from wherever that is, domestically or internationally. They come late at night, they stay at the hotel, they take a golf buggy to their office, and they might be medium-term stay guests, stay for a few weeks, or they might be just 2 or 3 days. You know, it's a super comfortable environment, and all of that challenge that is urban India is, frankly, outside the fence for us. So the hotels, that's why we've ended up at Manyata. We're now building two hotels, I think Hilton Garden Inn, 619 rooms together, plus a conferencing space of about 58,000 feet. Again, same rationale. And we've got a scale and a knowledge from our occupier base that really is second to none. We, you know, of course, we looked at our experience at Golf Links. We talked to our top corporate occupiers. We asked their travel buyers, what type of rooms are you buying? How many rooms per annum? So that we were able to actually make up the brief for what should we build? Is 600 rooms correct? What, you know, Hilton Garden Inn, different price points, and so on and so forth. So we've got a lot of market intel simply from our existing customer base. And the other thing, you know, great thing about that is the customer base actually account for 60% approx, plus or minus different years, but 60% of our new leasing comes from our existing corporate tenant base. So they're with us, they're loyal, and as long as we provide that complete business ecosystem to them, they're not going anywhere. And you put a hotel and a conferencing space and food courts on the park, they're not going anywhere, and they're paying a premium rent. And these companies are, because of the quality and sophistication of what people are doing, their sensitivity to rental is not the way it was 10 years ago, because they're really all about hiring and retaining
the quality people that are required for the sophisticated tasks. Yeah, but hotels, we're not wedded to them, other than we want them in there as the business ecosystem. So we would sell. We have been asked over the course of the day about what about industrial, because there's a Singapore listed REIT that has assets in India. That's not something that at present or in the foreseeable that we have any plans around. We are very focused on being the top player in the office space in the country. And on that note, I want to kind of acknowledge Aditya, who's from Embassy Group. Embassy Group have just been, this week, awarded by Euromoney the number one office and commercial developer in India award. And that, I think there were 3,000 people voted on that. So, you know, we've got a great sponsor in Blackstone, and we've got a great local sponsor in Embassy Group. So we're in a good position.
What's your expectation on the balance sheet? The leverage obviously jumps out.
Do you want to?
Yeah. So currently we have a pretty conservative balance sheet. So currently we are 11% as of June end, net debt to TEV. I think if we do undertake all the capital programs, we will lever up a little bit more over a period of time, but given the fact that it will also add up to the TV, we think we'll settle at somewhere between in the mid-teens. And then obviously any add-on acquisitions, if we do, we'll look at it from mix of equity and debt, and that may kind of push the debt level a little higher. From a regulatory perspective, there's a hard cap at 49%, and anything above 25% require unitholder approval. We, as a management team, we are comfortable at around 30-35% over a medium term. So maybe in 3 to 5 years' time, we are comfortable with the debt level at around 30-35%.
What about like debt to EBITDA? It's not
even full. Debt to
EBITDA. I think we have the stats there. So it's 2x right now. But
where do you think that goes to?
So I think maybe roughly double of that. So maybe 4x.
And so if you were to do a large acquisition, you would?
So again, the way the REIT regulations work is 80% of the value needs to be in completed assets. So it always, you know, it will always be in income producing assets, and hence we would not kind of, you know, make a huge acquisition through debt which is not income producing. 80% of the value of the REIT, of the portfolio, needs to be in income-producing assets.
Why can't you buy, like, stabilized property?
No, we can. Okay. We can. I'm just saying that, you know, it's we are not allowed by the REIT to buy the regulations to go and just buy, let's say, greenfield development projects.
Right.
So there'll always be projects which will have a little bit of development portion in it, but we will still look to buy assets which are largely stabilized with a little bit of development component, which will help in, you know, juicing up the returns and pushing the returns more higher.
But we could finance on, if we, let's say we do a large acquisition, right? Sure. I mean, if it's accretive and we make and it really fits sort of the profile out there, sure, we could finance a portion of that with debt. We could also, I mean, raise equity for it, right? As long as, you know, the one thing I think, look, in an interest rate environment right now, in a low interest rate environment, there's clearly sort of opportunity to go out there and tap the capital markets for it. But I think over the, you know, we also want to be prudent about what we finance and how we actually, you know, put integrate stuff into the portfolio right now. So it might take a few.
Just the leverage levels.
Understand.
Like someone abnormally low for a long lease asset.
Yeah. But bringing a structure like this to market takes a lot of sort of, you know, prudent capital management.
Yeah.
No. Also, what it does is just to add there is, you know, it just helps us to kind of have the ammunition as and when opportunities do come up in the market. And we've seen that with the NBFC crisis and the liquidity crunch in the market, we believe that over a period of time, there will be opportunities in the market. We being the first mover advantage, and Sarah mentioned about the upreach structure so we can swap for units, as well as do part swapping for units, part buying for cash, for currency. We think that will be in play. So we think having a conservative balance sheet helps to, make some accretive acquisitions in due course. So today, the bond that we did was around 9.4% yield to maturity, but interest rates have tightened since then. So I think today it would be in high eights, so 8.8, 8.7, with the FPIs opening up. So FPI is now being allowed to invest in debt securities of REIT. We think we can kind of push it to sub 8.5 in due course. Ideally, we would love to see it sub 8 in 12 months time frame from now. But, you know, it all depends. So the stock has traded up a bit recently, but on a completed portion, I think it was somewhere in the mid six.
Great. So thank you very much, Mike, Vikash, Aditya, and Ritvik for sharing your thoughts on Embassy Office Park REIT. They're obviously there tomorrow as well, so if you have any follow-up questions, do feel free to catch up with them. It's a very exciting, high-growth, high-yield story. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your time.